Good morning, good afternoon. Thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I turn the meeting over to Linda Whitney. Please go ahead. Your line is open. Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome to our latest trustee teleconference. My name is Linda Whitney. I'm a scheme actuary here at Aon Hewitt. My role is to chair this call this morning, the latest in our series of quarterly calls where we pick up topical issues in pensions. These calls are designed to supplement our regular trustee training courses and also the face-to-face conferences. At the moment, the main Aon Hewitt Pension Conference series is running, so if you're not getting along to one of those around the country, do contact your consultant and get yourself along to them. The calls mainly focus on issues from a trustee viewpoint, although clearly we will throw in some reflections from the employer perspective so that you see both sides. As Anna said, you'll have the opportunity to ask questions towards the end of today's teleconference, so do jot down any thoughts that you have so that when we open the lines for questions, we've got plenty of thoughts from you. Joining me on the call this morning are Paul McGlone and John Belgrove.
Good morning. I'm Paul McGlone. Like Linda, I'm a scheme actuary, and I also advise a range of trustee boards.
And good morning. I'm John Belgrove. I'm a partner in our investment consulting team, and I advise UK and public sector pension scheme trustees.
So in today's discussion, we're going to cover some of the key items and key findings from the UK version of Aon Hewitt's Global Pension Risk Survey. This will hopefully help you to understand where you're facing the same issues as your peers, or perhaps where you might be unique. We're going to explore three main areas. The first area will be around long-term objectives of defined benefit pension schemes. What are those objectives? What are the timescales for reaching them? And how have they been impacted by the current economic climate? The second area we're going to cover are, as John likes to put it, the three D's of investment: de-risking, diversification, and dynamism. So we'll be coming back to those three later. And the last area we'll look at is the management of benefits and liabilities, looking at the continuing trend to close schemes to new entrants, freeze them to accrual, and de-risk the liabilities, rather than just focusing on de-risking the assets. So, to give you some context for the results of the survey that we'll be discussing, this is a survey we've run every couple of years, so we've got a good back history now to get the trends of how clients are changing and how the risks and issues they're facing have changed. In the 2013 survey, we got over 240 responses in the UK, and that covered schemes with around 300 billion of assets. Now, about half the responses were from trustees like yourselves, but we also got a good number from sponsors and pensions managers. And where applicable, we might be drawing out some of the similarities and differences between what the trustees said and perhaps what the other side of the table said. There's a wide range of scheme sizes covered, and again, another interesting area where we'll draw out some similarities and differences is where schemes of different sizes have different aspects that they work on. So, we'll start by looking at the long-term objectives of schemes. So, how are DB schemes expecting to reach the targets that they set? Paul, do you want to just start off by talking a little bit about what schemes are looking at as their long-term targets?
Yes, absolutely. The biggest issue that this survey shows is actually a continued trend that we've seen over a number of surveys, that schemes are increasingly having a long-term objective that isn't simply their technical provisions. So if we go back to 2009, less than 50% of schemes had in mind a low-risk target, most people still have in mind simply that getting full funded on their technical provisions. By 2013, we're seeing about 84% of schemes say that they have a long-term objective in mind, which is stronger than their technical provisions, which is typically something like buyout or what they might call self-sufficiency, but it's certainly a low-risk target. When we dig into that in a little more detail, we found that about 20% of schemes are targeting buyout specifically, but the largest group is aiming at this idea that they call self-sufficiency, and that's a phrase that doesn't have a unique meaning, although each individual scheme tends to know what it means by that. What they have in common is that it's usually close to but not at buyout, and it's a level of funding that is adequate that the trustees can pursue a fairly low-risk investment strategy. So that's the biggest change over recent years, and we're now at a situation where less than 10% of schemes don't have that sort of long-term strategy in place. So if you're in that camp where you don't have something in mind other than just your technical provisions, you're starting to look a little bit out on a limb compared to the rest of the market.
So, Paul, you picked up the general direction of long-term objectives. Is this one of the areas where we see any differences between big schemes and small schemes?
There is some difference, certainly. As in most areas, the larger schemes tend to pick up some of these ideas a little bit faster than the smaller schemes. But it's not that dramatic. Most small schemes now do have a long-term target in mind. And actually, they're more likely for that target to be buyout than the larger peers. Something like a third of small schemes have buyouts as their long-term target. And that's the sort of, whereas it's only about 10% in the large schemes, that's the sort of difference we'd expect on the basis that larger schemes are generally less interested in buyouts, perhaps because the market doesn't exist, but perhaps because they actually want to get to a position where they can run on for a number of years with their own low-risk strategy. Smaller schemes are, as I say, are targeting buyouts a little more often. Some of that, I believe, is because they simply don't want to run a self-sufficiency strategy over a number of years. There may also be the fact that they simply can't afford to, the small schemes don't want to run a self-sufficiency strategy. In reality, they will get close enough that they'll simply jump to buyouts and put a check in at some stage in the future.
So how long do we think schemes are taking in general to get there? How long do they think it's going to take to get there?
Well, the realistic timescales for when schemes can reach their targets are definitely being pushed back with current market conditions, partly because schemes are getting more ambitious, so we'd expect it to take longer if you set yourself a more ambitious target. But a lot of it is because of the economic headwinds that we're seeing. If you go back to 2008, in the survey we ran that year, over half of schemes expected to be fully bought out within a five-year period, and that suggests that half of schemes should be fully bought out by now. Now, that simply hasn't happened. Admittedly, that was in the heady days when new insurers were entering the market, and everybody thought that, you know, the world would be fine and they'd be able to buy out their schemes. But even if you look after that, by 2009, the average scheme expected to be sorted out by 2020. By 2013, the average scheme expects to be sorted out by 2025. So in a period of 4 years, our target dates have moved out by 5 years. Now, that's no great surprise given the economic conditions, but it does demonstrate timescales are moving out, and I think the regulators see the same thing.
And I think that's quite interesting as part of the debate around smoothing, because it actually shows that schemes are finding a route to smooth eventual contributions by actually using the length of time that they've got for their plan as the flexible item. So the next step when thinking about the long-term objectives is the path that you're going to take to get there. So what sort of methods are we seeing schemes use to get there?
Well, the idea of a flight plan or a journey plan is now commonplace, and each scheme has their own phrase for what they're doing. The common theme, again, in all of these is having a route that's going to take you from where you are now to your long-term objective. So whatever it's called, the principle is fairly similar. What we asked in this survey was for schemes to tell us not just what their target was, but whether the plan they had to get there was robust, whether it was a fairly basic plan or whether it was simply an aspiration. And we found there was a mix across the market, as you'd expect. Around a quarter of schemes told us that they had a quite robust plan in place that had been subject to some rigorous design and challenge, and they were confident in it. Around 40% said, yes, they had a plan in place, but it was fairly basic, so it hadn't been stress-tested perhaps as much as they would like. Then a third of respondents actually had no plan at all, other than an aspiration. And these are the schemes who are saying, yes, we have a target of being bought out, for example, but actually we have nothing tangible to support that and to get us there. And that's the area we're seeing, I guess, most work at the moment amongst trustee boards, is taking those long-term targets, and where it is just an aspiration, trying to turn it into something more tangible. As in other areas, size is a factor. The larger schemes tend to have put more time and effort into making their plans robust, while smaller schemes are likely to be more aspirational at this stage, but clearly working on it to improve those.
So having set your target and having thought in broad terms about your flight plan to get there, there's then lots of investment issues, interesting areas that trustees I know love to get their teeth stuck into to understand about what they're going to actually invest the scheme's money in. So the three current themes in investment, the three Ds of investment, de-risking, diversification, and dynamism. So, John, over to you on de-risking.
Well, thank you, Linda. Yes, well, I do have, I think, probably slightly a cheesy phrase about top trustees seeing the investment situation in 3D. And as you said, those Ds have been named. But I think that they relate to quite long-lived trends now. I'm not really just referring to today's investment fads. So in terms of the first D, de-risking, the trend out of equities, and especially domestically listed equity, and into bonds has really been steady for around 12 years now. And that's obviously for well-understood reasons. But if we look at it point to point over those 12 years, which is obviously extends beyond this particular survey, but the average equity allocations have now almost halved from around, say, nearly 80% to around 40% today, while bond allocations have more than doubled from, you know, approaching 20% to over 40%. So that's really quite dramatic if you look at it in those terms. And that, you know, is consistent with the accelerated closure of pension schemes. And indeed, we remarked in this particular survey that there was a sort of watershed crossover moment that came in 2012, as the average pension scheme, you know, it was demonstrating they had more allocated to bonds than equities. So I think that puts into perspective the kind of long-run cult of the equity that we've perhaps been acclimatized to. And maybe we should be sort of coining the phrase cult of risk management for these times. Now, the de-risking D remains a very powerful trend, as I've illustrated. But whilst there's appetite for further equity reduction, I think the willingness to acquire more physical government bonds at this point in the cycle is definitely looking a little bit more muted now, and the search is on for yield in a wider set of instruments. 2013, from the survey point of view, marks the lowest level of respondents looking to actually buy gilts or index linked. Although I've got to caveat that there was still strong appetite for credit and derivatives. That remains pretty significant. But I'd say that the credit cycle is also sort of looking a bit stretched now. Now, I quickly want to say something about LDI, if I may, and hedging interest rate and inflation risks. And just to be fair and to sort of declare my position, I'm personally a bit biased in favour of LDI frameworks. But our surveys found very different attitudes towards complexity between different sizes of scheme. And we suggested that perhaps smaller or mid-sized schemes don't actually necessarily need the complexity if, in effect, they are setting out their stall to rush headlong in towards a buyout rather than the self-sufficiency, self-sustainability that we talked about earlier, which requires more more complex asset management. But worryingly, I suppose just to pick up a couple of other elements on hedging, almost no respondents said that they will hedge these risks at any price. And I contrast that with, say, something like 10% or plus of respondents that typically say they'll hedge currency risk regardless of price. So there's a very strong view in the industry about perhaps mean reversion when it comes to gilt yields.
So, John, what would mean reversion mean in this context?
Well, there's an expectation of a sort of a long-run fair value on gilt yields rather than necessarily acting in what the forward curve is telling us. I think probably more concern to me is that the survey shows that nearly one half of plans either have no policy or say that they will not hedge their inflation or interest rate exposures. So it's, I mean, that's quite a significant element that don't have a plan. And those schemes that have been in that position have really suffered in the last few years as liabilities have soared due to declining real yields. And look, I mean, LDI techniques are available to all sizes of schemes via pooled geared products. So I'd say that, you know, size is not necessarily a limiter. Governance may be, but I think probably the biggest limiter or barrier at the moment is price. But we should remember that doing some hedging now is buying at the future yields that market expects, and the market expects yields to rise quite a lot. Admittedly, our own medium-term view is that we expect yields to rise even more than the market expects yields to rise, although the gap to fair value is not as big as you might think now that quite a lot has changed since last summer's gilt yield lows. So I think, you know, in conclusion on this topic, I'd say that decisions are very individual and they should reference both where you are today and where you want to get to be in the future, the flight plan elements that Paul was talking about. I think hedging has become something of a vicious circle for some trustees, and there appear to be correlations between funding level and policy whereby the most poorly funded plans are perhaps the least likely to have a hedging policy.
I think that's interesting, John. You said correlation, but which is the chicken and which is the egg? So what's the actual causality rather than the correlation? Are we saying that having hedging has improved funding levels, or are we saying that schemes with better funding levels have led them to take more hedging activities?
Yeah, I see what you mean. I think that's slightly tricky one to deal with. But let me say, I think it's important to understand which end of the telescope that you put to your eye, if I might be so bold. Is the reference point for a scheme 100% hedged to start with and then decide how much risk you want to take from there? Or is the starting point where you are, which I would say on average is about 30% hedged, and decide at what price you want to extend that? So to try and specifically answer your question, hedging in itself should not improve funding levels relative to funding levels that are priced off the hedging instruments. But what hedging does do is it provides more control over your funding journey. So to restate the obvious, hedging interest rate and inflation exposures will have really helped funding levels in the last few years relative to unhedged strategies. But relative to liabilities, it has really just helped those schemes keep pace with that liability growth. But I do acknowledge some of the chicken and egg elements here. Better funded plans are also more likely to have put hedging in place to protect their position. And it's certainly the case, which is quite challenging at the moment, depending on where you are on the spectrum, that the gap between the very best and worst asset returns and, you know, hence funding levels typically, absent of massive company contributions, the gap between those two has never been wider.
You commented earlier, John, that smaller schemes weren't hedging as much or weren't expecting to hedge as much in the future. Do you think that's because they really want to maintain all those risks and remove them in a single big bang package in a buyout where they can get rid of interest rate, inflation rate risk and longevity risk all at the same time? Or are they missing out on something by not attempting to manage some of the risks as they go along?
Yes, well, I think it's justifiable to keep things simple. and to go for the big bang approach, as you suggest. But I think it's justifiable if your sponsor covenant can support it, because obviously, you know, if you do that approach, you're accepting some sort of mark-to-market risk, which is absolutely fine. And I don't think, yes, many small schemes should be looking at de-risking into self-sustainability if indeed they want to go straight for buyout. So many of the tools that are available may not be, you know, they may not wish to access them. But it is a sort of horses for courses. There'll be other schemes of that size that do want to do that. I think it's also interesting to note, as you might expect, that there's a strong bias for small plans to not yet have a flight plan policy, as again, as Paul alluded to. And, you know, similar to other comments we've made, this might be as a result of fewer resources, lower governance, or perhaps just not needing to be involved in that level of complexity and to get within, as was stated, check writing distance. And for those schemes, yeah, clearly the emphasis is more on asset growth ahead of risk mitigation. But it helps to have a good covenant backing that.
So making sure that you think about the regulator's complete financial management plan, where you're thinking about funding, investment and covenant, and where we've been talking here about big schemes and small schemes, actually it's just as important whether they're supported by a bigger employer or a smaller employer and the strength of that employer. John, you focused there on interest rate and inflation risk. The third piece of the package, if people are going for buyout, is longevity risk. And although it's an investment decision, I'm afraid this is what I get excited about, so I'm going to pinch this bit from you, John. Looking at longevity, it's quite noticeable that in the last global pension risk survey, a quarter of plans had indicated that in the next couple of years they were very likely or somewhat likely to undertake some form of risk settlement where they dealt with some of their longevity risk. However, in practice, only a very small percentage have actually done so. So speaking to clients, it seems that many schemes were surprised at the data issues that they had when they wanted to go and seek pricing. So, for example, did they actually have information about the spouse's benefits that would be paid after the member had died, held on their computer system? Was that data clean? And actually, we did see prices vary depending on that quality of data. The combination of the quality impacting price, but also impacting on readiness, meant that actually we think some people weren't able to take advantage of opportunities. The big opportunity in 2012 was those schemes who had already done significant general asset de-risking and were sitting on a large portfolio of gilts. And there, if they were planning to sit on that portfolio of gilts for the long term, and perhaps not go down some of the other routes that John was talking about in terms of diversifying their bond assets, well, actually, they could have said, I'll pass those gilts to an insurer, and I'll get my longevity cover effectively for free. And you say, well, how on earth is that possible? Free cover, I just hand my gilts over, and they'll give me something for nothing. Well, that worked because the providers were able to invest in a mixture of gilts and corporate bonds, and they could use that yield pickup from corporate bonds to offset the cost of longevity cover. Now, today we've seen that pricing come off a little bit, and you're now looking at needing to pay something of the order of 0.25% per annum to cover the longevity risk compared to a pure gilt portfolio. But it's certainly an interesting area and one that schemes should keep an eye on if they are going down that route of having a significant matching portfolio where they do want to focus on government gilts and then that move to buyout. But sorry, back to the next D of John's list, diversification, and that's both on return-seeking and matching assets.
Yeah, thanks, Linda. I mean, interesting, that last section. I mean, I think there are lessons there in terms of sort of being ready and being nimble, and we might sort of tackle some of the nimble elements in the third D. But the second D is diversification. And the appetite for more alternatives in asset terms remains very strong, and we see that coming through very clearly from the survey once again. And so it's fairly long-lived, and possibly respondents will also put multi-asset products into this area too, such as diversified growth funds, which are gaining a certain amount of popularity. Now, diversification remains perhaps the most widely accepted free lunch argument in investment. And notwithstanding that correlations rise in times of stress, i.e., you know, when we get crisis, a lot of assets start behaving similarly. But so diversification is not a solution in its own right. And we should also be wary of diversification for its own sort of own sake. There's got to be a return argument in terms of the assets that you put in a portfolio as well. The extra comment I would like to, on this topic as well as I'd like to make is this, which is, and I think this is true especially of larger clients, but they've got used to being pretty forensic on the defensive part of the portfolio. It's much more commonplace now to be thinking about separating your decisions around interest rate and inflation hedging, maybe using leverage more routinely for capital efficiency, maybe picking up bits of the credit or bits of the curve that they particularly like. And I think you know, that's also reflected in the 30% of respondents in the survey that said that they expect to use more derivatives in the next year or two. Yet when it comes to the growth assets, clients tend to be less forensic, I think. You tend to get sort of these big pre-prepared meals of growth portfolios lamped at your table, you know, perhaps a big portfolio of global equities or even of, you know, a whole range of different growth assets. And I think one trend that we might see in the future is that the growth side getting more granular, and as trustees get more cost conscious and think about accessing particular parts of the growth story that they really like. And I think developments such as so-called smart beta and alternative beta products could feature in this area.
Okay, so some new terminology there potentially for some of the people on the call, introducing them to terms like smart beta, alternative beta, where schemes are looking at that granular issue within their portfolios. I'm sure that's one for another time to delve into in a bit more detail, or if you want to ask questions about that at the end. But on to your last D, John, dynamism.
Yes, well, this is more commonplace now, and clients have really become to recognise that market opportunities, you know, can come and go very quickly, and it's really challenging speed of movement for trustee decision taking. Markets keep gyrating, and you suddenly find, you know, a risk or an opportunity springing up very fast. And dynamism is a word that I think reflects anything from perhaps pre-agreed triggers, right through to very kind of fundamental active asset allocation mandates. And growth of these has been significant. When we asked about sort of dynamism, nimbleness in 2006, there were very few that were using that as a core to their strategy. The static allocations of the 1990s and early 2000s were dominant, but things are definitely starting to move. And more clients are these days getting comfortable with the notion of sort of fair value for different asset classes, and more comfortable with a bit more fluidity at the asset allocation level as one of the tools to use in you know, trying to close the deficit in a controlled way. Now, one of the ways of actually ensuring dynamism is implemented in practice is to delegate if the governance is restricted, and arguably delegation could be a fourth D, perhaps, Linda. I don't know, but unsurprisingly, we find that area has greatest traction with smaller and mid-sized clients, who typically may lack the internal resource to deal with increasing levels of market complexity and speed. Bigger schemes are more likely to do more things for themselves, and indeed, you know, that's an extending trend where we see more recruitment of in-house resource and expertise to the very larger schemes, and I think they're very unlikely to be interested in delegation.
So you're not necessarily saying delegation is something that is right for everyone, or that is something that we're necessarily pushing for everyone, but recognising the differences in different schemes?
Oh, absolutely. No, it's really about sort of thinking about the spectrum of ways of solving a problem. I think, you know, I feel very passionate about this, but, you know, what I want to see from our consultants is that they deeply understand clients' individual needs and requirements and beliefs and structure solutions or answers to that based on those very deep and individual understanding. And certainly delegation, we've always known is not for everyone. That's always what we've said. We thought that it might settle at around sort of 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 in the market. And nothing is telling us to alter that view at this point in time, other than perhaps the acceptance or speed of acceptance has been a little bit more faster than we expected. And possibly the financial crisis did a lot to convince certain trustees that they need a bit more help. It's very interesting from our surveys about how delegation or fiduciary management has moved in a few relatively short years from a position of perhaps, I don't know, dare I say, suspicion and distrust to a concept that's more widely accepted and regularly embraced. I think perhaps the stronger hedging ratios typical of fiduciary solutions have also accelerated the trend, because in pure performance terms it's been a great time to be delegated. But I think that would be a misleading buy signal. I think the future of using this for trustees is probably looking at it more selectively. Less common is the it still exists and it'll still be there for many schemes, but I think less common is the all or nothing delegation discussion. More common is the partial delegation. Do I want to hand over a specific job that relates to my investment? Yeah, perhaps the liability hedging, perhaps the, I don't know, selection of hedge funds. So I'm seeing more evidence of that.
Okay, thank you, John. Moving on to managing the benefits and liabilities, the third section of today's call. Paul, I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about the sorts of changes that we're seeing in relation to liability management at the moment.
Yes, of course. Let me start with the trends that we've seen for a number of years, which is the continued trends to close schemes, both to new entrants and to future accrual. Closures to new entrants really took off around 2000, and we've seen that increase over subsequent surveys. It really started to plateau around 2010, and we're now in a situation where only about 10% of DB schemes continue to accept new entrants, and those certainly tend to be the larger schemes. Closing to existing members, that really started to take off around the mid-2000s, and the 2013 survey suggests that this is up to around about 45% now. Again, the rate of closure is lower in larger schemes. At the small end, around 60% of schemes are now frozen with no future accrual. At the large end, it's more like around 25%. Those larger schemes tend to also be the ones that, rather than closing to all accrual, are taking other steps such as pensionable salary caps or switching to career average. Aside from closures, other changes do continue to happen, such as reducing benefit levels or changing discretionary benefits, but as you'd expect, those are less frequent because as there are fewer and fewer schemes that continue to have any accrual, there's fewer schemes who can do things like change the benefit levels.
So that's mainly about not making future DB pension promises or making any future DB pension promises that you are making smaller and more contained. But what about the liability management where schemes are actually trying to work with the liabilities that have already been promised?
Yes, well, that's, that continues to go on, and that's more difficult. As you know, liability management in the broadest sense has attracted quite a lot of negative publicity recently, stemming from some dubious practice in the early years. The pensions minister and many others were quite concerned about what was going on, and so the minister was quite vocal and set the wheels in motion to produce an industry code of practice. And while that was being developed over the last couple of years, a lot of schemes really put liability management exercises on hold because there was uncertainty as to what was going to happen. So there was a period where not a lot happened. But the code was launched last year. It had involvement from a lot of people in the industry, including some of our specialists. And that really cleared the way, once the code was launched, for such exercises to restart again, albeit in a more controlled manner and with various safeguards in place to protect the members. So what the survey shows is that we expect pension increase exchange exercises, or PIEs as they're often known, to be adopted ahead of things like enhanced transfer value exercises. And it was the enhanced transfer value exercises that really kicked off a lot of this and got a lot of the bad publicity. But pension increase exchanges, and particularly options at retirement for members, are attracting a lot of attention. So a PIE option at retirement is where, like in the DC world, a member reaches retirement and is given the option of having either the increasing pension, which is described in the scheme rules, or a level pension instead. It can only be done for certain types of benefits, but there are certain advantages of this approach in that members do get a decision when they reach retirement age. And it's actually an issue where a number of trustee boards are raising this proactively themselves rather than waiting for companies to raise it. Trustee boards are seeing that it has value to members, that they can tangibly say, look, this is a good option for us to put in front of you.
So it's a choice between a higher level pension or their existing pension as it's been described in the scheme rule, but would increase during in the future.
That's right. And like commutation, it's a choice the member gets to make at retirement. And also like commutation, it's something where you can anticipate a certain level of take-up and build that into the funding of your plan.
Oh, so that's why companies would like it then?
Yeah, absolutely. The companies will get something out of this as well. Those things aside, though, and they're probably the contentious areas, the most popular liability management option actually is probably the simplest and the oldest, which is trivial commutation of small pensions. It's definitely a safe and an easier option, although the clue is in the name, trivial. It's unlikely to have a significant financial impact, although it can take a bunch of members out and therefore reduce your administration costs, for example. And I guess what's most interesting to me is whether these exercises generally start to increase in popularity. Over the last 2 years, the biggest factor affecting the funding position has been not the scheme's assets, but the scheme's liabilities. And while we're in a situation where liabilities are perhaps 50% bigger than our assets, still most of the attention on de-risking has been on the asset side. So as the gains from assets exercises start to reduce, if we get to a position where assets are, I'm not sure they'll ever be wholly under control, but if we get to the position where we've done most of what we can do on the asset side, I expect we'll see a lot more interest in them managing the liabilities as well.
I'm sure John will argue there's new things coming along all the time to continue to manage the risk on the asset side too. But thanks very much, Paul. So the three areas that we've covered today have been the long-term objectives of your pension scheme, and I'd like to pick out that you probably are out of step now if you don't have a long-term objective that goes beyond your technical provisions. And with the regulator's interest in complete financial management plans, this very well might be the year that you need to start that conversation if you haven't already. With investment issues, have you thought through all those stats that you need to be able to de-risk, diversify, and ensure sufficient dynamism? And that's practical steps as well as the more interesting investment areas that John was focusing on for you to invest in. And managing the liabilities. Now, although some of these actions do need to be led by the company, it is interesting that Paul was drawing out the pension increase exchange at retirement and trivial commutation, which are both exercises which absolutely could properly be led by the trustees. So some actions for you to take away there. Hopefully you've been jotting down questions for us as we've gone along. If I can hand back to Anna now, and she'll explain how you can ask your question.
Yes, certainly. So we begin now the question and answer session. If you like to ask a question, please press star 1. Please unmute your phone and record your name clearly when prompted. If you wish to withdraw your request, please press star 2. So star 1 for a question. One moment, please.
Well, while we're just waiting to see whether we get questions on the line today, we did have one question emailed in advance, which was around how you actually measure and monitor the plan as you go along. So we've talked quite a lot about flight plans, about hedging, funding, triggers, etc. But how do you actually go about that measurement? John, do you want to pick that up first?
Well, I think one of the, you know, very significant areas of change in the industry over the last few years, and there have been a lot, haven't they, when we think about it. The survey's only been running since 2006, yet it's captured a period of huge movement and change in the industry. It certainly can't be accused of being glacial. And one of those is in the way risk is measured. So I think if I go back to the start, there was definitely a separation of measuring assets and liabilities, and the, you know, perhaps you kind of did your ALM once every 3 years and then sort of stuck it on a shelf to collect dust. So today's trustees are very much focused on combining those two together and more typically monitoring their funding level on a more real-time basis. You know, I appreciate it's not a substitute for the valuation itself, but it's a regular part of the monitoring process. Statistical measures such as value at risk are used as a guidance for clients in thinking about the types of risks that they are running. It's becoming more common to use things like scenario analysis. You know, what if this happened in terms of economic circumstances? What if, you know, euro breakup? What if, you know, some other element? What would it do to assets? What might it do to our funding level? So, I mean, I think there's a lot more focus and awareness around risk management. And I believe that, you know, whatever the markets might throw at us in the future, and it's bound to be, you know, plenty of things that none of us see for coming, that the structures are now a little bit better placed to deal with those because of thinking about risk and being more nimble.
Yeah, I guess all I'd add to that is I agree with John. I think we've seen an increase in both the type of things that are monitored. Funding level is one, covenant is another, and also the frequency of which things are monitored. So funding position is monitored more often than it used to be, so are asset values. The challenge I always lay down to my clients is whatever you're monitoring, you need to understand what you're going to do with it. Having lots of information on a regular basis that is simply, you know, in the trustee packs and doesn't feed into decision-making, it is probably wasted time. And it may well be that, you know, three times out of four, you get information and you don't do anything with it, but you have to have a mechanism to look at the stuff and where it is telling you something to act upon it.
Anna, have we got any questions on the line?
We have no questions. So once again, if you like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name clearly. Thank you.
One comment that you made earlier, Paul, was around check writing distance and what it would take for a company to be willing to pay that extra bit into the fund and get that last bit, particularly if we're talking for smaller schemes, over the final hurdle to buy out. So what sort of things do trigger for a company to write that check?
A whole mix of things, Linda. It's a phrase which I first heard of a few years ago, actually, when I was talking to a client about their funding position, and they expressed this idea that if the scheme got within a certain distance, then they could quite easily build a business plan to write a large check, which was something like, it was between 5 and 10 years worth of contributions, simply to make the scheme go away. And the sort of rationale was probably threefold. Number one, it does take risk away from the business, and there's a price to be paid for that, and companies are willing to pay a price to take certain risks away. Number two, a very practical one, it means you don't have future expenses. So you can look at the expenses involved of running the scheme, the trustees' costs, the employers' costs, doing accounting figures, paying the PPF levy, you know, all of that, and say, actually, it's worthwhile paying a single sum up front to remove that. And the other is simply management time, that while the scheme continues to run, the trustees and the company both need to spend a substantial amount of time on dealing with the plan. So although this phrase of self-sufficiency is a little bit meaningless at times, the idea of check writing distance, I think it's within the resources of every trustee board and every company to ask themselves, what would our check writing distance be? How close would we have to get to buyout before we felt there was a business case for the company to go and raise the capital and make the scheme go away?
And that's a business case on an ongoing basis. And if you start getting into sort of merger and acquisition territory, then potentially that changes the ballgame again.
Oh, it does, yes. As soon as you're in a situation where you potentially want to sell the business, for example, then there may be a larger check that is available to make the scheme go away in order that you can find the right sort of buyers and the right sort of price.
Anna, do we have any questions online?
We have no questions, thank you.
Okay, so in which case, thank you very much for joining the call today. There were lots of topics covered by the survey that we haven't had a chance to touch on today, including everything from 2013 valuation solutions, scheme mergers, complete financial management plan, defined ambition plan. So if any of those topics interest you, or if you want the hard numbers and haven't been able to catch them as we have been talking, please do contact us for a copy of the full survey report. So when you get the feedback email, do reply. If you want a copy of the survey report, just make a note of it there and we'll get a copy out to you. Once again, thank you very much for listening, and I hope you have a good rest of the day and that we don't have any nasty surprises from the budget later on.
So thank you very much for participating in today's conference. All lines will now be disconnected. Thank you.